Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, a podcast that's all about comic book movies, brought to you by FilmDivider.com. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are...
James Hunt.
And Matthew Turner.
So, unfortunately, Seb couldn't get to an early screening of Fantastic Four in time for this podcast, but on the flip side, it does mean that we are extremely lucky this week to be joined by film journalist Matthew Turner. Matt, do you want to tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself?
I'm a freelance film journalist. I currently write for Virgin Media, WOW 24/7, Shortlist, Digital Spy and various others, and I'm also a lifelong Marvel fan.
Maybe that love has been tested this week. Who knows? We'll have to get to the movie to discuss that. Okay, so there is no news this week because we're discussing a new release again, second time in a row. And this week, that is, of course, Josh Trank's Fantastic Four, or potentially Fox and Simon Kinbo's Fantastic Four. We'll get into that. Instead, hopefully you enjoyed our Batman Arkham Asylum episode from earlier in the week, and we'll be back to normal from next Wednesday on with a mini-sode next Wednesday and a full episode the Wednesday following that. So instead, this week, we will kick things off with a spoiler-free discussion of Fantastic Four. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, you can listen to our spoiler-free section and then pause there, go watch the movie and listen to the rest. And then we will launch into our main spoilerific chat. But before any of that, I am going to ask James to explain a comic book concept that, as a movie fan, I just don't understand. I'm just going to stick with Fantastic Four. It makes a lot of sense. Can you explain the negative zone, and is that what I've just seen in a movie this week?
According to Josh Trank's podcast with Kevin Smith, it is the negative zone. According to the film itself, you know, there's no clear indication either way. But basically, the negative zone is, it's a dimension, like, inverse to ours, which it has its own planets and inhabitants and, you know, civilizations and stuff. But the crucial thing is there is only one negative zone which exists for every other universe.
Okay, that's interesting. So in the Marvel multiverse, like 616 has the same negative zone as anything else?
As the Ultimate Universe, yeah.
Wow, so is that normally a good device to, you know, like, make crossovers happen? Is that a good way to get, like, I don't know, Ultimate Spider-Man and Spider-Man on the same page for a week? Or
in Ultimate Fantastic Four, they go to the same negative zone as the regular Marvel Universe, and that was the first time they ever sort of linked the two universes up in any way.
Right.
Yeah, it took a long time for them to go any further than that. But yeah, it's not how they did it, but it is one way they could have done it.
And does it tend to be a thing that is used a lot for the Fantastic Four, or is it something that pops up in lots of different comics?
Yeah, it's very much a Fantastic Four thing primarily, I think.
Yeah, in fact, almost entirely Fantastic Four. It's pretty rare anyone else would go there.
I'm sure if Fox get a bumper box office weekend this week for Fantastic Four, then maybe the X-Men could journey there.
Actually, is Doctor Strange not a fan of the negative zone?
He's more astral plane, I guess, isn't he?
Oh, they all have these things, yeah. These weird sort of other worlds, don't they?
And the astral plane isn't the microverse.
Or the negative zone, no.
Or the quantum realm.
I mean, crucially, like, Reed Richards is the only one who's got a doorway to the negative zone. So if you want to go, you have to go through him.
He's just got a doorway.
Well, he built the original portal and no one else knows how to do it.
Yeah, they basically chuck supervillains in there that can't be held in conventional methods.
I mean, I'm still very confused, but thank you for that explanation. Okay, well, let's move on now to our spoiler-free discussion of Fantastic Four. But before we do, let's take a listen to the original trailer for the movie.
Dr. Storm, we gave you 6 years and millions of dollars, and you gave us nothing. What's different now?
Reed Richards. He knows answers to questions we don't even know to ask yet. This is our chance to learn more about our planet and maybe even save it.
I want you to meet my daughter, Sue.
You want to be famous?
I just want my work to make a difference.
John, Reed.
This guy doesn't take orders well.
Yeah, especially from people who say, I don't take orders well.
Don't let any of these lab coats give you any crap, all right?
Well, if I do, I know who to call.
The muscle.
I gotta say, it's fun having you here.
Really?
No.
What you've created here is incredible.
You guys sure you're in the best shape to be doing this?
Yeah. We're good.
They just cracked interdimensional travel.
Incredible.
All I want to know is where are my children?
Four have survived. All exhibit unique physical conditions.
I just want to fix my friends.
You can't fix this.
You should use these powers to help people.
You opened a door you don't know how to close. You don't know anything about what's coming.
What is coming?
Right, so that was the trailer for Fantastic Four, which we have all now seen, and given that it's been in cinemas for a couple of days, hopefully a lot of you listeners have as well. James, I think I'll come to you first. What were your thoughts generally on this Fantastic Four movie? Where does it rank for you in the Fantastic Four movie canon?
I've not seen the 90s film yet. I've been saving that for when we finally get around to doing a podcast on it.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah, I would say it ranks somewhere between... It's below the first film and above shutting your fingers in a door.
Do you like to elaborate on that?
I feel like it was a lot of interesting ideas that maybe failed in the execution. Great, like, fantastic cast, like, no pun intended, like, you know, I really enjoyed the portrayals of most of the characters. First act of the film was great, and the second two, like, it was you who used the word crated.
Yes.
Which, yeah. I think, describes accurately the dip it takes.
Yeah. I would say that there is almost, there are three little words that doom this movie, and those are 1 year later.
Yeah.
Matt, are you on the same page as James and I, or are you more positive?
I'm slightly more positive, I think. I'm not going to kind of disagree with the fact that the third act is very disappointing compared to what's gone before, but I liked enough of what they did before to sort of see it through, really. And I agree, I think the cast is fantastic. Again, no pun intended. I liked a lot of what they did with the changing the characters and changing the sort of dynamic. I've got a theory about I've got a sort of comeback to one of the main criticisms, but I think maybe I'll leave that till we actually talk about it.
Very intrigued.
But let's put it this way: I liked it more than I liked Rise of the Silver Surfer, which I thought was actively terrible for most of it. I did like the first one, but the first one was flawed, as you know, the first Tim Story one, but the first one was flawed as well. I think this is interesting and flawed, but I do want to see the next one. Let's put it that way.
I mean, I'm definitely closest to James. And in fact, I think for me, enough things went wrong with this movie that I was actively reaching back in my mind for the last time I'd watched a superhero movie that I felt had been as bad as this. And I think we'll get into specifics on this, but a lot of the stuff that I like about the first half of the movie... Or as much as I think when I was watching it, I was like, this is solid. You've got me on side for now. I will be very interested where you go with this, because it did for a long time feel kind of slow, a little bit drab. The colour scheme is all silvers and greys and blacks, and I wasn't having an awful lot of fun with it, but I did think there is the potential here to do something interesting. And then there is a scene that occurs just about the halfway point where I was like, oh, now this is really interesting. And then those three little words again. And yeah, I think it's probably... I don't think it's as bad as any of these movies that I'm going to mention, but I think it's probably the worst superhero movie that I've seen in the past 4 or 5 years outside of Ghost Rider 2, Kick-Ass 2, and Green Lantern. And I hate to be that negative. I really hate to. And I hate to be that negative because there seems to be so many people out there reveling in this film being bad or reveling in the reaction to this film being bad. And like, oh, we knew it would be bad. And honestly, I think some of the reason it might be bad is because people were expecting it to be and that Fox have tinkered with it since. I mean, the evidence is on the screen that some fairly major changes have been made to this film in during the production. And I do wonder whether that was a reaction to people already damning it online.
But I don't think it's anywhere near as bad as Green Lantern. I mean, that's I actively hated Green Lantern, and and that was, and some of the others you mentioned were just terrible movies. I never thought this was terrible. I thought it was maybe disappointing in places, slow, like you say, but never like unwatchable.
I thought that, I mean, that maybe that's where we differ then, because for me the last 20 minutes were
atrocious. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the one it reminds me of most is Amazing Spider-Man 2, which I... I had the same reaction to Amazing Spider-Man 2 that I had to this, which is, like, it messed up what it was trying... Like, it took away everything that was good about the character, but didn't replace it with anything better. It was just so... It got off on the wrong foot and just went in the wrong direction. Like, there was no way of saving it by the time I realised it was going bad.
I'm actually quite a fan of Amazing Spider-Man 2 as well, and and as a sort of lifelong Spider-Man fan, I really got kind of what I wanted from that movie.
Different podcast, yeah.
Yes.
Different podcast, okay, sorry, carry on.
Just quickly, the other thing that I liked was the score.
Yeah?
Because I think Philip Glass was a good choice. Like, I forget who he was working with, but just, I like Philip Glass anyway, so I was enjoying listening to the music, if nothing else.
I will also say, like, in reaction to what you in comment to sort of what you said earlier about them taking away what was good about the character and not replacing it with anything interesting, I disagree. I think they made that work. The changes they made, I think for the most part worked, and I didn't think they were going to.
I think there's a lot that works about the setup of the five main players on paper. I think there's a lot that kind of theoretically or thematically seems like it's going to be quite interesting. I just never felt like it really came together, or the point at which it should have been able to come together, the movie stopped being interested in servicing any of that stuff, or just didn't. Weirdly, for a first half that's so slow, and there's not a huge amount of incident in the first 45 minutes. I was surprised come the second half quite how little I felt I knew about a lot of the characters and a lot of the character relationships.
Well, this is actually one of my main criticisms of the film, is that there were a lot of two-handers, and for something that's specifically about an ensemble, I don't think Ben and Sue get any scenes or any interactions that are worth noting. And it's like, it's hard to get a handle on the characters when they spend so much time just in straight conversations with no sort of, no variety. Like, it's just Johnny talks to Reed, Reed talks to Sue, Sue talks to Doom, and it's sort of, everyone is one note in all their conversations. It never really fleshes them out.
That does kind of play into what I want to talk about later, but again, it's been left till later.
Well, shall we bring our spoiler-free chat to a close there? Because I really don't think there's a huge amount we can get into without exploring specifics on this one.
Yeah.
And I hopefully think that if you've listened to that conversation, and haven't seen the film, you're going to want to either see it and listen to the rest, or just go straight on and listen to the rest. I think this is going to be a fun and lively discussion. So what we'll do now, we'll briefly listen to another quick clip from the film to give people a chance to not get spoiled rather than diving straight in. And then we'll be back with that properly spoilerific discussion straight after that.
All right, gentlemen, hands and feet must remain inside the ride at all times.
Dad, you need to come to the lab.
Don't blow up. Don't blow up. Oh, yeah, that's what I want to hear before going into another dimension.
3, 2, 1. Blow up. Okay, so that was a clip from Fantastic Four. And I think where I'd like to start, guys, is actually by talking about what this is riffing on the comics. So I think what we've assumed for quite a long time, and what I'm guessing proved to be true, is that this is basically an adaptation of Ultimate Fantastic Four.
Yeah, Matt, have you read Ultimate Fantastic Four?
No, I haven't.
No, neither have I. Like,
but I did read the Wikipedia entry.
Yeah, same. Yeah, like the bits of it I've read are from much later in the run. I think Doom especially is influenced by the Ultimate version.
Do you mean that visually or character-wise?
Visually in the fact that he's got a kind of goatee, and character-wise in that he's not a Latverian dictator.
I'd heard, obviously, that it was influenced by the Ultimate comics, but I hadn't quite realised until I read the Wikipedia entry just how much that was true. Like, there's a lot of... So the childhood history stuff, the childhood relationship between Ben and Reed, comes from the Ultimate comics. And the introduction of Franklin Storm also comes from the... the fact that Reed has a mentor, an older mm-hmm. mentor... also comes from the Ultimate comics. I hadn't realised that.
Yeah, and so in this version, then we've got Reed and Ben are schoolmates who kind of are very different in that Reed is pretty much a childhood genius, and Ben, although he doesn't get to say a lot, it seems that maybe he's not the smartest tool in the shed, but that he is. He forges a bond with Reed through trust and friendship, and that kind of trust and friendship is retained for like 10-15 years into the future when they grow up, and Reed is actually at the... Or is it? No, it's 7 years into the future.
Seven,
isn't
yeah.
It?
7 years.
I've got to say, I was so thrown by that opening scene. I'm an American football fan, and there's some little kid in like a flashback scene saying, "When I grow up, I want to be like my hero, Eli Manning." And I'm like, Eli Manning, the quarterback who's in the NFL right now, when is this film set? And then it flashed up 2007. I'm like, oh, wow, 2007 is a flashback. Also very confusing that in the movie, presumably, Reed and Ben are supposed to be 17, 18, while both looking about 30.
Mm-hmm. Is it a coincidence that 2007 was the year Rise of the Silver Surfer came out?
maybe that's where a young Reed Richards got his inspiration for his ideas by watching that film.
I'm also pretty certain they cut out like bullying scenes and stuff, like Ben rescuing Reed from bullies, or even Reed helping Ben with his kind of abuse at home situation. You know, I'm sure there was meant to be.
There's the throwaway line to his big brother saying it's clobbering time as he's about to beat the crap out of him, presumably.
Right.
Yeah. Which kind of beds the
thing catchphrase.
Yeah, the catchphrase of the thing, but also kind of hints at a domestic abuse situation. But it's all very quick in that opening situation, which is just Ben and Reed. And I actually really liked that. I don't know about you guys, but I watched those first 5 or so minutes thinking, oh, I'm getting a real like Amblin feel from this.
Joe
Dante,
yeah.
Spielberg, like mid to late 80s, and that's why I found it so jarring when it flashed up 2007.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right. It does have a real 80s vibe to it, and then it turns out it's 2007.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. I could have done with a lot more of it. I'd have been quite happy for them to have introduced even like, you know, Sue or something like that at that just, age, and had a whole first half of the movie.
Even if it was just, instead of being 5 minutes long, it was 10 minutes long, and you got a parallel scene with a
Sue
Storm
and Johnny
family adopting Sue.
I remember thinking it's kind of odd how we, the first time we meet Johnny and Sue, they're basically like grown up doing, you know, their own thing.
Yeah.
Like there's not much setup of their sibling relationship, so it doesn't, like when it's introduced, it just feels a bit sort of rote. It's like, oh, they're the Storms, you know this from the publicity. So
it did genuinely throw me, the whole kind of age thing, given that they all look so much older. So I was like, well, Miles Teller and Jamie Bell look older than 18, so I kind of don't buy them as 18 here. But then when Kate Mara and Michael B. Jordan show up, they don't look 18 either. So I'm supposed to think, well, are they older then? But I never really knew. And then I was also aware that of kind of stuff that James, you and Seba told me in the past, that like Reed and Sue are kind of like the parental figures of the group, and that Johnny and Ben are the kids. And so then I was wondering whether that was playing in at all. And then Victor was older but looked exactly the same age as all of them. it was confusing. I just wondered why they needed to be 18, or couldn't like Franklin Storm have recruited Reed when he was 21 coming out of university, say, instead of being 18 coming out of school?
I actually have an answer for that question. I think Josh Trank thought he was making a film about generational conflict.
There's stuff in that. I think there's certainly supposed to be, at the end of the film, I kind of think a sins of the fathers being visited on the sons.
Yeah, it crops up as a theme like numerous times that, like, especially the most notably, I would say it's Victor's speech where he's saying about how, you know, we built this thing, but someone else is gonna use it. Do you know the name of the people who built the Apollo rockets? Like, obviously not. And I think that, like, it feels to me like that was what Josh Trank was aiming for, and whether he missed it or whether it was sort of cut to ribbons in front of him is a, you know, different question, but.
Have you read the Little White Lies review?
I have not. That's the good one, isn't it? I know they gave it 4 stars, but that's all I know.
But it really goes into that. It goes into that in great detail, like the millennial conflict and like the sort of older sort of patriarchal society appropriating millennial creativity and turning it into but they're using it for their own purposes and things like that. It's a really, I mean, it's worth a read. You may not agree with a single word of it, but it's worth a read.
I mean, I haven't read that, but it definitely sounds worth a read, because I think that kind of stuff does, I think there are glimpses of that kind of stuff in there. I think there are glimpses of really interesting stuff about the theme of family, and it seems to me actually at the end of the film, or at least with some of the stuff that was set up in the film, the idea that Sue was adopted did seem like a really smart move, that kind of like blood doesn't necessarily have to define family, that family can be pulled together from different things. And the fact that Reed and Ben are so different from their home life and their intellect, but still form this really close familial bond, to the point where when Reed has his greatest moment, he wants Ben there by his side. And the fact that those kind of fractured ideas of what actually defines family, you can then pull these four people together to form a family at the end of it. And I think all that stuff that you just mentioned there, Matt, I think there were glimpses of that sort of stuff in the film. I just didn't feel like it ultimately came together. And whether there was a version of this film where it did, given how much of this film seemed to have been a little bit of ADR here, a reshoot there, shots inserted just to slightly change the meaning in scenes. There seemed like a lot that had been altered. And I do think that there was maybe a very interesting film to be made. And given what Josh Trank did with Chronicle, I think he at least in that film proved that, even if you don't like that film, that he sets his stall out with the ideas he wants to explore at the start of the film, and he explores them. Whether you like them or not, or whether you like the found footage stuff there, I think he does. And obviously he has a great script to work with. But yeah, I felt like there was just the tantalising glimpses at good ideas in the first half of this movie, and they didn't feel elaborated on. I was hoping that they would be elaborated on in the second half, and then the second half just felt like it was almost a completely different film.
Well, yeah. This is kind of getting close to what I've been talking about before.
This is a great tease. We're building up to this. Suddenly, okay. Matt is going to drop some bombs.
No, nothing like that. Nothing like that. But we've been talking about, one of the main criticisms of the movie is that they don't do enough in the kind of sense of family dynamic. Like, so the Fantastic Four was famous as a comic because it was Marvel's first sort of superhero family. And as you say, that dynamic's always been there. Reed and Sue are the parents. Johnny and Ben are the sort of bickering brothers or what have you. And so it's understandable that people are annoyed that those elements seem to be largely missing or at least underwritten in the movie. So, but my theory is that that's kind of deliberate in that it's more about them coming together at the end to work together, despite the fact that they don't actually know each other all that well. Yeah. Now, I don't think that comes across brilliantly in the movie, but there is a definite element of that. Like, so Johnny and Sue are essentially estranged, aren't they? Like, he's definitely jealous of her and jealous of her, of the attention she gets from their father.
Yeah.
And the kind of... the problem there is we don't know how Sue feels about Johnny. But we do know that Johnny's kind of not interested in sort of being around her and what have you.
There is definitely, we know how they kind of feel about each other's approach to the military intervention in the second half.
Yeah.
And the way that they're kind of both kind of opposed with how they should be dealing with that.
And I mean, similarly, Ben is, okay, he's Reed's best friend, but he's basically off screen for that entire kind of Baxter building segment until they get drunk and he calls him up. And again, so you don't have Ben as we've said already, you don't have Ben interacting with the other characters beforehand. And so Ben is essentially this kind of unknown quantity to them. And I think that was probably the intention for that finale, is where Reed is talking about, like, we have to work together. But I don't think they really pulled that off. I'm just saying that that's a reason that the family dynamic that people are expecting from the movie and that was in the previous movie, movies, isn't present in this version.
Yeah, but if that is the case, that last 20 minutes has to be so much stronger. It really does.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I would hope that the second movie would build on that quite significantly and show them and go into those relationships in a much more kind of intricate and expected way.
I mean, it is worth saying, like, you don't have to do the family dynamic just because it's the Fantastic Four. Like, there are other strings to that bow, and, like, Josh Trank clearly, like, the characters can support what this was, which was a kind of interstellar-type science adventure. Like, that's one valid way of using the Fantastic Four. Like, they're not just a family, they are also kind of astronauts and explorers. So, I mean, even though they didn't use the family dynamic to its full extent, like, I don't criticise the film for that necessarily, because I think it's possible to not do it.
I think also Reed is a real focus of this movie in a way that, like, the character of Reed wasn't a focus in the previous movie, and it was sort of equal balance between the characters in the first two films. Whereas here, it's very much about him, to the admitted detriment of the other characters. But I do think that is the point. Like, we're watching a movie about Reed Richards.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that if you look at a movie like The Avengers, which I think is kind of the gold standard when it comes to the superhero team-up movie anyway, that was a movie that spent 3-4 previous movies introducing each of those characters separately. So you'd done all the origins, you'd done all the this is who this character is, and then you had a whole movie of putting them together and actually letting them become a team at the end. So what that movie essentially had was 2 hours to do what this movie does in 45 minutes in the second half. Now, that obviously puts a lot of the burden on the first half of this movie, which I think you're right, it does give a lot of attention to Reed, and I think Reed is very clearly the best sketch character in the first half, very closely followed by Doom, Dr. Doom, Victor Von Doom, who, and Toby Kebbell does amazing work, I think, with the very little that he's given in the first half. I felt like I got so much of a sense of what that character was feeling beyond the dialogue he got, which, and I don't really blame any of the other actors for this, because I think all of the other actors do reasonably good work with being given very little, but I never got a sense of what Sue felt about anything or what Ben felt about anything, because they just get so little screen time. And I mean, yeah, to move Ben off to the side is fine if you want to focus on Reed, but then in the second half I actually thought The Thing was the best realised of all of the characters once all the CG comes together and they've got superpowers. I thought he looked really great. I thought you got that sense of how horrible it was to be this creature.
Yeah.
But I didn't know anything about the guy he was before, so it ultimately couldn't mean anything.
This is what I was about to say. Like, they focus so much on what he's lost and how, you know, how he wants to get his life back and how bad Reed feels for taking it from him, but we've barely seen, like, he lives on a junkyard and gets hit by his brother. Like, that's the extent of it.
And then the flip side of that is that, like I said, I thought they did reasonably good work with Victor in the first half, and Toby Kebbell was very good, except then he's absent for half an hour, he comes back for the last 15 minutes, he's covered in horrendous CG. I hated that character design, and I haven't read Fantastic Four comics, so I'm not a fanboy, but I can imagine if I was, that character realization would absolutely drive me crazy. I just thought he looked abysmal. And Toby Kebbell's performance was completely obscured. He didn't feel like the same character, and I was like, well, that really interesting character from the first half, maybe if you gave the first half of Victor and the second half of Ben to one character, that would be a good arc. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel like any character in the film had that.
Yeah,
I'm going to mount a fairly flimsy defence of Doctor Doom, in that you can't do the comics character as we've discussed. Like, you can't have him be the Emperor of Latveria and what have you. And also after the first movie, after the previous movie, you can't have him be the sort of metal mask wearing thing that Julian McMahon did. So you have to get away from that. And I thought they did a pretty decent job of... okay, it wasn't the comics Doctor Doom, but I thought they did a pretty decent job of getting away from that. And I also... Okay, I didn't love the costume, but the way they explained that that his kind of suit had fused with his flesh, I thought played into the... well, we haven't talked about the body horror aspects yet, but played into the body horror aspects of the movie that are kind of apparent later on. And so that was quite a nasty sort of touch. And yeah, all right, they didn't do kind of enough with his face, I don't think. But he did have, like, real power. Like, that scene when he's striding through the building and attacking everybody was genuinely like, oh my God, he's, like, insanely powerful and actually genuinely a threat for...
See, like, okay, I have to disagree with that assessment, because I, like... There were parts in this film, like, I don't know what it was like when you guys saw it, but like, there were bits where the audience were literally just openly laughing at how ridiculous the film had become. And that was one moment where he's doing his scanners thing, walking around the corridors, like, blowing up people's heads. People were just laughing at how ridiculous things had gotten.
I quite liked him bubbling Tim Blake Nelson to death. I thought that was... that. I mean, again, we will mention the body horror, particularly in that middle sequence. But I thought that looked cool. And I was fine with him doing his whole Cronenberg scanners thing. What became an issue for me was when they have that final showdown in the negative zone. Those powers didn't seem evident. It was like he had those powers, but then suddenly someone could distract him for a second and he didn't have them anymore, or just like he got kicked and then all of a sudden he wasn't this all-powerful thing. And I didn't believe for one second that the plan that the team mounted at the end to defeat him, which was, oh, so terrible, so terrible.
Yeah. But
Miles Teller looking over his shoulder and going, am I not as smart as you? Now! And then it takes like a full 5 seconds for the thing to appear and walk forward, have the time to deliver its clobbering time, and then punch him into a big blue laser that flies into the sky. And I was like, well, if you've introduced a character being that powerful, you can't have him taken down that easily.
Mm-hmm.
And this, yeah. I mean, and third acts are a problem for lots of superhero movies. I've mentioned many times before that the MCU struggles with them. But I think the MCU normally struggles with them for like maybe 5 or 10 minutes right at the end of the film. Whereas I felt like this was having those problems for like pretty much as soon as it flashed forward a year.
Well, there was no like continuity in what he wanted before he got his powers and what he wanted after. Like, at first he's talking about he wants to have his inventions and, you know, get the glory, and then he gets his powers and he's just like not even a comic book sketch of a villain. He's just like ranting, insane, one note.
Like, well, he wants to be the god of his own planet.
Yeah, but it's,
but he already like was.
He was the god of his own planet, but then he wants to destroy the old one in the process because they didn't recognise his brilliance.
They didn't respect his authority.
Indeed. I mean, I got it. I just didn't think it was... Yeah, maybe we were missing spending some time with him in the neutral zone. Not that I would have wanted that movie to do that, but...
Negative zone.
I was disappointed, yes, that he went back to Planet Zero. I was hoping, like, you know, when he was kind of when he came through to Earth, I was hoping that the climax was going to take place there. And then when they opened up the kind of portal into the sky, the portal between dimensions that we've seen that can potentially destroy the other dimension that we've seen in so many kind of fantasy and comic movies, including the Avengers, obviously.
Yeah,
I just thought, oh god, not this again.
I mean, there needs to be a moratorium on blue lasers shooting into the sky. There really does. Just change the colour.
Yeah,
at the very least, make them a different colour. And actually, that final showdown reminded me of the Green Lantern in a way. I remember watching the Green Lantern going, well, he's got this ring that lets him like do anything that his imagination allows, and he comes up with racetracks and giant fists. Yeah. And Doctor Doom can shape this entire landscape on his whim, and he comes up with a couple of jagged rocks. What? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't help this. I felt this film had such a dreary visual palette. Obviously, very deliberately. And you know, they went for those lo-fi black suits. But I just thought, well, maybe pep it up a little bit. At least make this final showdown interesting to look at in some way.
One thing that's interesting is all the energy on Planet Zero in the trailers was red.
Oh, really?
In the movie, it's conspicuously green. It's like they kind of looked at it and went, this looks a bit too familiar. Like, can we change it to something a bit weirder?
Oh, that is weird.
Wait, so they changed the energy from red in the trailers to
green in the film, yeah.
Are you sure that green looks colorblind.
Horrendous. I don't know, it looked like toxic sludge that you would see in Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, well, in the trailers it looks like lava. So I'm guessing that's why they did it, to make it look more alien, but...
I quite like the green energy, actually.
I mean, I thought there was a couple of absolutely like clunking shots in that sequence where they go to the negative zone and get the powers and everything goes wrong. The moment where Victor gets splashed with all the energy and then screams and falls back all felt like it was out of time, almost, that like he was screaming at the wrong point. And it was, I mean, that was one of the moments where I found myself laughing. James was like, this just is so ridiculous. And I was thinking back in my head to Chronicle, and there was a moment that really recalls Chronicle. I think Josh Rank probably did it deliberately, where like Johnny reaches out towards the energy and rocks start floating and there's like a little bit of static electricity. And I was thinking, back when I was watching Chronicle and they're getting the powers in that cave, I was so interested in that tiny little glimpse of that cage and of that cave and what those powers were, and the kind of slightly like pulsing, shiny, almost like organic-y looking rocks. And I was thinking, oh, I really want to see more of that. And then they did the same thing, kind of, but with this green ooze. And I was like, God, this looks ridiculous. How do you execute the same scene twice, but so much better the first time around?
Well, quite. Just since we're talking about them going to Zero for the first time and getting their powers, there's something that is complete and utter bullshit.
Yeah.
And that is leaving Sue in the normal dimension. Like, leaving her back at the building while they get drunk and go off.
The whole way through the movie. They sideline her at any given opportunity. It was what you were talking about on the Ant-Man podcast about kind of, like, Hope having to be kind of the straight-laced serious one while the men goof around.
Well, it's the perennial problem with women characters, isn't it? Like, you know, they... Like, in Sue's case, yes, she's a maternal character, but they don't all have to be like stern mothers to the crazy kid men.
No, well, and we've already established this is a film that is giving you different takes on those characters.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you want Sue to not go, you have to justify it for a better reason than she, like, she still gets her powers, but she just gets them in a rubbish peripheral way.
Worse than her not going was the fact that they gave her powers by having her sitting at the computer when the machine dematerializes in their dimension, and there's like an explosion and she's caught in it. And that's how she gets her powers.
Yeah, like, it turns her into a victim of circumstance, as opposed to, like, a character with her own agency. It's just, of all the decisions the film made, that's the one that just, I can't see any good in them making that decision.
No, I have to say, I mean, as much as I'm trying to defend the movie, that's its really serious misstep for me. It's only really serious misstep for me, is that sequence. Although, what they should have done with it, is, you know, like, immediately after the ship demeteriorizes, she gets her powers and whatever, there's a shot to the city, and they have that kind of pulsing wave that goes through the city and knocks all the lights out and stuff.
Yeah.
Right? They do a very similar thing on The Flash, on the TV show The Flash, when the particle accelerator or whatever explodes and the whole city basically gets a kind of wave like that going through it. If they had set up so that basically the thing that gave that sort of wave that gives Sue her powers also gives a whole bunch of other people in New York City superpowers, that would have been quite good. And then you could have easily set up like future Fantastic Four villains and things like that.
Maybe that's what mutates people in the Fantastic Four universe. I mean, I didn't really like what I didn't like that it was drunkenness that sent them into making that decision in the first place. I mean, yeah, Vixxer was obviously driven by jealousy and that whole kind of, like, the other generation taking the credit, the other people taking the credit for what they had done. But for Reed in particular, I mean, obviously Ben barely has an impact on it, but for Reed and Johnny, I kind of wanted it to be driven by something more than alcohol. Like, it would have been really great if actually Reed did have some hubris that he needed to serve, or that just it was like some incredible folly, some like overconfidence, but that, like, the alcohol for me seemed to mitigate it somewhat. And then, yeah, you're right, not taking Sue along, not having her part of that bonding was disappointing.
Yeah.
Then her not coming along, and I mean, I feel like they'd been sidelining her the whole way through the first half of that film. She smiles once in the movie when she's flirting with Reed, in a scene that I don't think really works anyway. And then in the second half of the movie, I mean, similarly, they're all experimenting with their powers, and everyone seems to know how to use them perfectly, apart from Sue. She seems to be the only one who has to struggle with them somewhat and is keeping trying to learn them, whereas Johnny and Ben are off, they're ready for military work, and Reed has, by the time he's got back, pretty much figured out how to get his powers down. And Sue's still learning hers. And it felt like a horrible misservice of that character the whole way through. And if people had problems with Black Widow in Age of Ultron, I mean,
yeah.
This is the character that should launch the think pieces.
Yeah.
I mean, Joss Whedon's on the right side of this. Fantastic Four is on the wrong.
I mean, does Fantastic Four even have any other named female characters? Like, you see Ben and Reed's mothers, like, for sort of one and a half scenes each.
Yeah,
like, that's it. Second, and then there's Sue, and is there anyone else?
I don't remember. I don't even remember seeing many female scientists around the Baxter Building.
Really, exactly. Don't think there is. No,
like, I criticised Ant-Man for having a grand total of like 4.5 female characters.
And that's 3.5 female characters than this has.
Yeah.
Are we are we going to talk about the body horror stuff before we talk about the 1 year later segment?
Yeah, absolutely, because that for me is the best 5 minutes of the film. I don't know about you guys.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I thought that was where the film was at its strongest, to be honest.
It's the tease that goes to you, okay, they've just had their powers, now this is happening. Oh my god, what if this is the rest of the movie? I was watching it going, there are so many times in superhero properties where they kind of go like, oh, but what if the government got hold of you and such, and what they might do to you? And I think we've probably seen glimpses of that in X-Men with Wolverine, but this was flat out, they had, the second they got the powers, the military had got hold of them and were flat out torturing Reed, and it was really uncomfortable. And that had come straight after the shots of Reed looking around to find his friends, and one of them was burning and one of them was trapped inside an enormous pile of rocks.
Actually, I thought that reveal was fantastic. When I saw it coming because it was fairly obvious what they were doing, but it was still a great moment when he's crawling and crawling and crawling and really struggling to crawl. He's got his leg trapped under a heavy thing, and he's crawling towards Ben and crawling towards Ben, and then he turns around and looks at and sees his leg stretching away in front of him, and then basically passes out. I thought that was a great moment.
Yeah.
And again, like normally in superhero movies, and even in the previous one, in the previous Fantastic Four movie, they pretty much go, oh, cool, I've got superpowers. Look, I can do this, I can do that. Ooh, stretchy powers. And he was like, oh, my fucking God.
You know. This is something that I think, like, if you want to do a body horror superheroes, that is fine. And I think it's well executed in this. I do think, tonally speaking, it's wrong for the characters. Because, like,
I don't think it was wrong. Was it wrong for the characters that were established here, though?
It's wrong for the property, say. Because, like, Fantastic Four is, aside from the fact that they've got, you know, the word fantastic in the title, like, it's an upbeat, I don't want to say hokey, but, you know, it's a kind of, you know, it's supposed to be fun. And making a man who sets on fire into a kind of horror David Cronenberg thing isn't much fun.
I mean, I don't know, I couldn't disagree with you more here, James. This is one of the times where I'm like, well, look, this is a movie adaptation, you've taken an idea, and if a film has a fresh original take on it, and yeah, there is a guy who sets on fire, and there is a guy who turns into rock, and there is a guy whose body completely stretches out of all kind of physical norms, that does sound like the perfect material for body horror. Yes, it's called The Fantastic Four on the page, and it's upbeat and it's fun, but I reckon if you just put those component elements down in front of someone in 2015, you can make a suitably nasty, unpleasant kind of body horror.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Superhero film out of it. And this film does for 5 minutes. And I think the biggest disappointment was that it didn't follow through on it.
I think more to the point, if you're going to do a reboot, I mean, the previous two movies were already that kind of fun, you know, even quite slapsticky, sort of joyful, and yeah, sort of enjoying being a superhero kind of side of things. I think if you're going to do a reboot, you can't, if the Spider-Man movie showed anything, you can't just do the same thing again. And this really is it took a bold new direction, and I thought it pulled it off. In addition to the bits we've mentioned, I really like the, I don't know how big X-Files fans you guys are, but I really like the Reed slithering through the air vent sequence, which yeah. which reminded me a lot of Tombs. Yeah,
if someone remade E.T. and made it like an alien invasion movie where E.T.'s chums come and like rip the planet to bits,
which people, is what the sequel was going to be,
people would go, what the hell is this? And that was why combining Fantastic Four and body horror makes me just, you know,
that's fine. But similarly, people, I mean, like, you got a sequel to Aliens that was no longer a horror movie, it was a big action movie, it wasn't what the property was, but executed really well, it's really great, and it's one of the great examples of its genre. And I don't see any reason why this movie couldn't have been a very good example of a darker take on the superhero, despite the fact that it is based on the Fantastic Four. I think actually probably a good example is, a good counterpoint is Man of Steel, which isn't a movie I love, but that is a film that took a very different take on Superman from what exists on the page. And like it or not, I think that movie is a lot more successful at slapping that tone onto that character. And I don't like the movie, but I think it is a more successful attempt at doing what this movie tried to do. But I don't see any reason why either of those movies couldn't have succeeded while completely departing.
Well, in fairness to Man of Steel, it's called Man of Steel. This movie is called Fantastic Four.
Also, let's not forget that like it's only one element of this film. It's not like that body horror element is going to continue into the next film where they will presumably be used
true,
to their
yeah,
powers
but
operating
like,
as a team.
If anything, that makes the scene more out of place.
I mean, it was my favourite thing about the movie.
It was my favourite thing.
I think it was the thing that was most well executed
to me as well.
It wasn't my favourite thing.
But then we get the 1 year later. So Reed runs away and leaves Ben there shouting, kind of like, help me, help me. And by the time we flash back, the movie's ruined. Right? Because the whole film has been setting up this idea of like how this event is going to affect these characters and ultimately bring these characters together. And that's the point at which we stop really caring about any of the characters, and they're all completely split apart. And there's no character work done in the second half. It's just this character's doing that thing, character's doing that thing. Reed is captured, Reed's brought back, and then Doom returns.
There's a year's worth of character development, but it all happens off screen.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, wouldn't you want to see the thing that bridges the gap between those characters being essentially tortured and experimented on and having these horrendous things existing to their bodies just to a year later where they've kind of got that shit figured out? It doesn't seem like Ben has spoken to anyone else in the intervening year. Know that Doom hasn't, we know that Reed hasn't, and the only characters presumably that have interacted are Johnny and Sue, and they are barely talking.
And that's the other weird thing that I didn't get about that whole sequence is that we should have seen them working as a, like the military should have had them working as a team. Why didn't the military have them working together as a team? They just had the thing out there smashing up tanks, Johnny flying around blowing up planes, drones, and Sue doing whatever Sue was doing. And that was it. It was just such a... And also to buy the idea that Reed would spend an entire year out in the wilderness, just learning how to mold his face and looking for machine parts.
Yeah. See, another part of the film that got an intentional laughs was the bit where Thing is ripping a tank to bits, and then I think it's Kimmy Schmidt's dad, whatever actor that is.
Tim Blake Nelson.
Tim Blake Nelson refers to it as being a covert operation. And people are literally laughing at the screen. Like, there is nothing covert about ripping a tank to bits.
I have to say, there is this thing about the kind of atmosphere in which you see a film. And I saw it on the Wednesday morning National Press show. And so there was only, probably only about sort of 20 or 30 other sort of film reviewers there. So there wasn't that laughter. We didn't have that kind of,
no.
You know, there was no kind of real fanboy presence, if you like, in the audience. So it made,
I watched it in a public screening, one of these Cineworld Unlimited preview screenings, and there wasn't an empty seat in the cinema, but it was dead silent the whole way through. And I can tell you from what little I overheard of people talking as they left the cinema, that wasn't because they were enraptured. It was because they were like bored.
Stunned.
I think really, really bored.
Right.
I mean, that's another thing I would say about this movie. It's a terrible criticism to make, but it's a boring film. It's a really boring film for long stretches, because I think it has pretensions to address those themes of family and the generational stuff, and Josh Trank has name-dropped David Cronenberg. There was an attempt to do body horror Cronenbergian stuff in this film, and I think because it doesn't come together, you don't get the enjoyment of this really subtly built and executed movie. You don't get the payoff to the slow burn. And so that slow burn just feels like a slow burn that fizzles out. So ultimately, I mean, this film doesn't go for it. You've basically got the sequence where they get their powers in the neutral zone. I keep calling it neutral zone. The negative
zero.
Zone. Yeah, Planet Zero, and then you get the showdown at the end, and that's it. There isn't really action outside of that. And
well,
I don't want my superhero movies to be all action all the time, but you've got to pay off what you establish. Otherwise, it just feels like a drag, and I just think this movie's going to be really boring for people.
I did enjoy the Thing versus Mr. Fantastic sequence. The Thing versus Reed sequence. Well, I know it should have been longer, but it was good because the effects were quite were well done. They used actually the one thing I do want to say about this film again, they use Reed's stretchy powers much better on screen here than they did in the previous films. Like the kind of way he was fighting.
Well, it was
and
just
stuff
comical
like that was,
in the last one, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, they barely did anything except to have him stretch his arms, didn't they? In the last one, I don't. And maybe
I seem
flatten
to remember
himself.
His neck stretching like around doors and stuff like that. Yeah.
Does he flatten himself under a door or something in the same point? And at least they actually had him fighting in this in a way that was interesting, and somebody had thought about, okay, how would you fight if you could stretch various sort of
limbs.
But again,
I mean, I'd compare that to like the scene where Thor fights Iron Man in the first Avengers film, and that is such a thrilling sequence. And yeah, they I think they realise the thing really well, and I think they show the stretchy powers pretty well, but it lasted 2 or 3 seconds, and that's that. And we like Thing has one swing at Reed and misses, and then
he
just drags
him
off.
Doesn't he?
And
yeah, well, that's the thing. Like how, yeah, like he takes out Reed by headbutting him, but Reed is made of rubber. So how does that work?
Yeah.
I mean, that for me, that's like a niggly thing. But what I would much rather is an action sequence or a sequence where these two characters, one best friend who has just been betrayed or seemingly betrayed by another, when they finally meet again after a year, to actually have some real character beats in that, other than one character say, you left, and the other one say, I'm sorry, and then it ends.
This is a genre thing that Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV series, did very well, which is that to recognise that fights in superhero comics, and by extension films, are supposed to be metaphors for character conflict.
Hmm.
Like, you don't have a fight for no reason,
yeah,
especially when it's between two heroes. Like, the fight is an expression of some other aspect of their personality or emotions.
Which I feel, and I don't want people listening to this think that we're just MCU fanboys, except I probably am, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
but the last two Marvel movies this summer have done that. They have done action that means stuff. And I don't think Avengers Age of Ultron's a masterpiece by any stretch, and Ant-Man's not either, but they're both solid movies that have figured out what they're doing within their given formulas, which is the same. And they're at the very least competent from start to finish. If that's not your bag, it's not your bag. But they know what they're doing. And this film at so many points felt flat out incompetent.
I agree that was another kind of wasted opportunity. But there is a long kind of Fantastic Four, sort of rich Fantastic Four history of Reed and Ben falling out and Ben feeling betrayed and resenting Reed and wanting, sometimes wanting to kill him and things like that. And it's so to just sort of acknowledge that. Well, I was glad they acknowledged. Let's put it this way. I was glad they acknowledged that. Yeah.
But that for me would be like almost the thesis of this film. It acknowledges stuff without really exploring it or paying it off. I mean, that is, yeah, yes, that's interesting.
It acknowledges Reed and Sue's relationship, but doesn't do anything with it. It acknowledges the idea that maybe Doom wants Sue for himself, but doesn't do anything with it.
And that's fine if the idea is, oh, we've got all this fertile ground to explore in a sequel, but well, it doesn't make actually, for a good film.
I was going to say exactly that. And it's perverse to say it, but the fact that it wasn't there in this film made me kind of... I thought that was quite a bold move, like leaving that sort of stuff, leaving essentially the character development for the second movie. Like that's kind of what I was getting at earlier. Okay, it doesn't really pay off, but it was... But I think it was deliberate.
Risky strategy, though, isn't it?
This is a film that was announced... with very shortly afterwards a sequel given a release date. I mean, I think the next Fantastic Four film is supposed to be released in 2017. I mean, whether that actually happens now, I think probably this movie needs a very, very strong box office performance this weekend to get a sequel, because I think it's on like something like 7% on Rotten Tomatoes.
I was about
at the moment.
To look it up.
So obviously the
I thought
critical
the sequel was happening anyway. Is the sequel not happening anyway?
Well,
there'll be conditions, won't there? There'll be box office conditions.
I mean,
whether...
Green Lantern got a sequel announced when that came out, and it just didn't happen because it wouldn't. I honestly think now for that movie to still actually move forward and happen, it would take a really pretty strong box office performance. And if it doesn't get that, then the only way I can see the Fantastic Four returning is with some fairly major propping up from the X-Men.
Right.
Okay, so kind of after Ben has brought Reed back in, we finally got the Fantastic Four in one building together. And Reed can suddenly fix all the problems that they've been having for the past year in getting back to the Negative Zone, despite the fact that they'd already been there.
That was another bit I liked, the line about I'm just sort of tweak the source code, and Tim Blake Nelson goes, it can't be as simple as that. Like, he's really pissed off. And it's
one of the things that
the kids know that he doesn't know.
That was one of those moments where I was like, oh yeah, Miles Teller's really charismatic. He can sell a great gag like that. Mm-hmm. I can't believe kind of that I walked out of this movie thinking, yeah, I think all of those actors kind of got those characters right and disliked it as much as they did. I mean, like I said, I thought Toby Kebbell was really great with the little he got. Nice that he got to share the screen with a monkey again after his starring role in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. But yeah, so basically, Reed tweaks the machine, which means that they're able to go back, except this time they're not allowed to go, so people are actually going in their place that time, which I found really strange that they're like, okay, yeah, we're sending people back. I mean, I know you guys went and fucked shit up last time, but now you all have superpowers, so maybe you would be the best people to send.
Yeah.
And you know, and you've been there before.
Well, that was fine. I mean, I had that thought at first as well, and then I realised what they were essentially doing was sending over a bunch of red shirts.
Yes, yeah. And so Doom comes back, and yeah, you're right, Matt, it continues that theme of body horror with that. I actually, when I say that Doom looked horrendous, I liked that idea that his suit had fused with his body, and like actually from the neck down I thought the costume looked fine, and when he put a cape on and you could see the body in the cape, I thought that was great. It was just his face was awful, and I have a real problem with, I mean, you use the two Hulks as an example, Ed Norton's Hulk, which was, there was no Ed Norton discernible in that Hulk, and now you look at what Mark Ruffalo is able to do, because he is doing genuine performance capture, and he gets to emote with his eyes and move his lips, and there is the character behind that there. And considering how relatively well, I thought they did with the thing. The voice modulation, I think, works to the character, especially because Jamie Bell's American accent was dodgy at best beforehand. But with Doom, and considering how impressed I was with Toby Kebbell, for him to just be nothing, no way to emote whatsoever.
It was a bit 60s Doctor Who villain, wasn't it? Just like rubber face painted silver. He spent a year sort of hanging around on Zero doing nothing, apparently. Like, he made a cloak, and then he injured his leg at some point shortly before they came back.
Well, Reed says it all looks different, but we don't really...
Well, it just looks... It looks to me that, like, it's flat, whereas before there was a cliff.
Yeah, well, like, it did explode just as you were leaving last time, so that's probably a small factor.
Hmm. What does Doctor Doom have on the page? Because I genuinely don't know. Like, all I know is what he looks like. What does he do?
He is a genius, and he has his kind of Iron Man-style armour, and he has learnt sorcery for reasons that I'll get into one day.
Okay, yeah.
And he can fire, like, you know, sparkly bolt things from his armour.
Right,
yeah, so he's basically like the evil Iron Man, if you want to look at it that way.
Well, he's also the emperor of his own country, and so he's essentially a sort of dictator.
Yeah.
And designs on world domination and all that sort of thing. And also, he just has a really cool name.
Oh, that line in the film, guys. That line in the film.
God.
Oh, she says... Oh, no, Sue says, Dr. Doom over here.
Yeah.
Right, guys.
No. And I don't know if you remember, I was reminded of this by one of our pals over at Film Divider, Brendan Connolly. That in the marketing for this film, he was Viktor Von Domashev.
I know the answer to this as well.
And that was definitely something that was going to happen. And you could... I mean, I don't know if you spotted, but through the film, a good way to see it from a visual point was Kate Mara's horrendous wigs. In one scene, she's rocking kind of normal, kind of like... blondy hair that's a little bit ragged and has kind of brown roots, but then at other times she's wearing a wig that looks like she's just borrowed it off Jessica Alba in 2005, and at other times it's different lengths. And so obviously this film has been called in for some fairly heavy reshoots, and I thought that scene in particular where she says, "Oh, Dr. Doom over here," was so clearly a reshoot. And in fact, I thought a lot of the scenes where kind of Franklin went in and was talking to them individually felt like they had been added in later. And it all seemed to me to be like plot explanation or telling you what someone else was thinking rather than actually doing any of those character moments. So I just have to wonder what was taken out of this film to be replaced by all of those awful moments. And there is some fairly clunky ADR. I don't know if you noticed it as well, but I kept seeing things and thinking, this is not from the original pass of this movie. This is so much stuff.
The Domashev thing. I don't think they ever officially released that name. Like, it leaked and people panned it, rightly so.
But why rightly so? Why can he not be Von Domashev and then name himself Doctor Doom afterwards?
Wasn't he, at one point, wasn't he supposed to have a Doctor Doom blog?
I think that was something that Toby Kebbell said, that he was like a blogger, and I think by that he meant that he was that long-haired kind of guy on his computer, kind of hacking into stuff and causing havoc on the internet, basically.
Like, again, right. whether you believe Josh Trank or not, like, on the Kevin Smith podcast, he was directly, like, before the release of the film, he was saying, like, that was never the intention, and that was, like, a name they were using on set to obscure the kind of comic book origins, which was a thing he wanted to do. Because, like, you know, he didn't give any of them... Like, he told them all not to read the comics.
Right.
He said that was never intended to be in the film. Whether you believe him or not is another matter. But
back to Sue's hair thing. I actually thought it was quite a nice touch. I noticed the change, the initial when she's suddenly blonde, much blonder. But that was in the... that was kind of after she'd had her powers for a while, and I thought it was maybe...
It definitely happens earlier on as well. I definitely noticed it, like, 20, 25 minutes into the movie. I think it's, like, after the first scene that Reed and Sue have together in the Baxter building in the library. The very next scene where you see Sue, she like walks from one room with longer hair and then is platinum blonde with slightly shorter hair, and literally as she walks through a door.
Right.
I think I mean that's why I kind of, I'm not sure if I said this on mic or not, I would love to go back and watch this film again kind of with a fine tooth comb. I would love to hear an honest oral history of this movie to figure out what changes were made and when and what was reshot and why things were changed, because
yeah,
I genuinely think this movie has been one of those that has changed things in the past 6 months in reaction to the first trailer, in reaction to the way that the internet has talked about leaks, and the way that the internet has written this film off as a failure from 6 months out. And I do wonder whether if it had been left alone and Fox just thought it was tracking fine, that we might have had a lot of those interesting threads actually pay off.
Well, specifically, the final act is so ridden with like cliches and like unearned moments that you just have seen 100 times in any other film. Like I feel like the whole ending was written by committee, and it just feels like they said, like, when Franklin dies, have him tell them to become a team.
Oh God! Oh, when he spoke. I mean, yeah, that was actually one moment where my screening room actually did laugh, which was when Franklin, given that the last guy got bubbled and burst to death inside like a hazmat suit, that I just assumed that something similar had happened to Franklin, mm-hmm. But no, he's laid on the ground so he can have his one last message to his children, yeah, saying, be a team. And everyone laughed. Everyone just flat out laughed. So let's talk about that final showdown. I mean, Matt, are you on the same page of us here that as soon as they go through for that final fight in the negative zone, it is a whole lot of nothing? Or was there anything that you found to like in that final fight?
Reluctantly, yes, that is. I had the same kind of sinking feeling, really, when that started happening. I would have liked the finale to have taken place in the on Earth for one thing. Apart from, like I was saying, where I thought like they deliberately kept them apart so that they could come together to fight Doom, and that idea being there, there wasn't much else to it, really.
At the start of that final act, for all four of them to run separately and try and use their powers and all be stopped, and then suddenly they're all able, even though Doom has got these all-powerful powers, suddenly they're all like, they're able to throw the rocks off themselves and finally stand up, and Sue, even though that energy is pounding down on her, eventually disappears because Doom gets knocked over, and then they literally walk back together and say, we can't beat him. He's strong. He's stronger than each of us. Yes, but he's not stronger than all of us together.
No, he is. He definitely is.
He definitely is.
Have you seen what he's done?
Yeah.
He'll blow your head up as soon as look at you.
And so their plan, and even that final thing of them all teaming up to defeat Doom, they don't actually need Johnny to do that thing that they do. Like, so their plan is to get Johnny flies at him, and he kind of like takes a bit of a hit and then fires Johnny away, and then Reed runs up and starts doing his stretchy stuff to
no effect.
I assume let himself be to be grabbed by Doom, but let him monologue for long enough that Sue is able to sneak up the thing invisibly, unleash the thing, and the thing can then deliver a catchphrase and then punch him hard enough and directly enough into the laser.
Yeah.
It's bad. It's really, really bad.
The bit in that fight, I think Johnny like sets him on fire, and then the thing tries to chuck a giant rock at him, and then Reed walks up and does like a stretchy punch right in his face, and it's just like, is this like, this is the extent of our imagination, is it?
Yeah, and as I say, like, none of those powers would ever have any threat to the Doom that we saw five minutes earlier.
To the head-exploding maniac.
Yeah, and Doom doesn't even get to say anything other than, like, to, like, briefly recall that he had a rivalry with Reed, which I liked the idea of the rivalry, but it kind of just left it there. And then I guess they were trying to do some more with the fact that Reed was the one who dropped Victor.
The thing about their relationship in the comics and what makes it work and what makes Doom such a good villain is that he's so arrogant, and yet all of his failures are his own. and he blames them on Richards because he can't handle being second best.
Hmm.
And I thought when he fell into the, you know, into the green energy and it was Reed who ostensibly couldn't hold on to him, I thought they were going to make a big thing of like, you know, I'm this way because of you. It's your fault. When actually it's all Doom's fault.
Yeah. And there were hints of that at the start with like Doom, when he calls Reed over and he's like, oh, you should be doing your work. And he's like, oh, I've done my work. And yeah. He's like, no, you're being inappropriate.
Yeah.
I quite like that. And the facts that, I mean, I liked a lot of these ideas on paper that Victor would be attracted to Sue as well. And like he says at the end, like, oh, we should have been together, Sue. And you're thinking, well, that would be a theme or an idea that would be interesting if you had elaborated on the idea of there being a potential relationship between Reed and Sue. But unless you know the source material, that's not in this film, other than they flirt a bit in one scene.
It's hinted at something, but not followed up on it.
In literally one scene.
Yeah, well, everything, like all of it, there's literally one.
And what was all the stuff about her recognising patterns? Just so, and her, like, listening to music, just so she could find, to have an explanation that she could find Reed? I mean, that would, if that was, I was expecting maybe that her being able to spot patterns would have some impact on the final showdown with Doom.
Yeah, again.
And the way that she understands people, could have got a better understanding of Johnny, or maybe she could have had a better idea of what the military wanted to do with them and explain that to her brother.
It would have made sense.
Yeah.
But none of that comes to fruition. And that's not something you just drop in a film that someone, like, and mention two or three times about someone being great at spotting patterns.
I found it weird that they were like, oh yeah, she's good at spotting patterns and she's making environment suits. Like,
yeah.
What? She's spotting the pattern of the fabric? Like, yeah. Really? What's that got to do with anything?
Well, she's a woman, isn't she? She's good at designing.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that is, for me, the, of everything this film does wrong, that's the one that I can't actually get my head around what it was in the first place, and
yeah,
how anyone thought that was a good idea to treat that character the way that they did.
Particularly now, when they're so aware of those issues coming up time and time again, like the badly treated female characters, badly written female characters in properties like this. It just seems crazy that they can still make all those mistakes in 2015.
Kind of look back at Chronicle and the way that film treated its one female character.
Yeah.
And I think, well, he's kind of got form and just no one's explained to him, like, don't be a dickhead.
I mean, to be fair, Sue is not, like, you know, in the early, perhaps it's better later on, but throughout, like, Fantastic Four history, Sue was pretty badly, like, used, like, in the comics too. Like, she's basically just in love with Reed and worries about everybody, and that's kind of it.
She, like, at first she's there to get captured and rescued, like...
In the
60s comics, it, you know, it's not great.
But it's not an excuse, but that was the 60s and this is 2015.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there have been complaints about the use of women in all three superhero movies this summer, but, I mean, I think, actually, when you go back and look at it, man, Age of Ultron did a good job compared to the two. It really did. And I think hopefully we are reaching a turning point. I was just watching today, like, this Funny or Die video where Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart are interviewing each other about American Ultra, actually, coming from the writer of Chronicle. And it's, like, set up as a, what they, like, Kristen Stewart is asking Jesse Eisenberg the questions that women are normally asked at junkets, and Jesse Eisenberg's doing the opposite. And, you know, films are even now kind of factoring that into their marketing. Like, I think there is an acknowledgement at some kind of higher level that this is a thing that, at the very least, the internet responds positively to and passionately to, which is to draw attention to the gender imbalance in movies as a whole, but particularly blockbuster movies at present. And it feels like we are kind of reaching that point of no return where it is now in these movies' best interests to do it the other way.
Yeah, exactly.
These movies, like, aren't just for teenage boys anymore.
They don't want the negative press of, oh, look, another film where women get sidelined.
Hmm.
Like, if that's all their motivation, then fair enough, because ultimately it's going to lead to better films for everyone.
Okay, well, I think that brings us mostly to the end of our discussion. Do you guys have any closing thoughts or anything that we haven't mentioned? Or Matt, if you just want to make one final defense of this movie or reminders of the bits that you liked about it.
I no.
I think we've ground you down with it.
I think we've said it all. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, can we talk about the final scene? Because the final scene for me was like some kind of slow, hellish torture. after the previous 15 minutes, like, I guess that this wasn't a film that was ever going to like find it easy to brand them as the Fantastic Four at the end. Yeah. But, like, I remember, James, when you were getting annoyed about the Ant-Man marketing being, scared of calling him Ant-Man or making a joke out of it. And then we actually get, like, a full-on, like, two-page scene at the end of this film where they're pussyfooting around the idea that they're called the Fantastic Four from now on.
Yeah. I have to say, I quite enjoyed the badness of that scene. It was awful. It was awful, but I quite enjoyed how awful it was.
I was like shriveling up in my seat again. I was thinking
they're going to cut before he says it, aren't they? And sure enough, that's what they did.
In the screening I saw again, everyone was just like audibly cringing, like going, "No, don't say it, don't, please."
And I guess what they were doing there was setting their stall out for what this potential sequel would be, because there's that moment where, like, Johnny says something to Ben about, like, how about we call ourselves the three guys and the thing that no one invited? And, yeah, because I have seen the previous films and I know that Johnny likes to banter at Ben, but at the end of that movie where they've barely spoken to each other, I was like, whoa, yeah, dude, leave that guy alone.
It's just mean-spirited, isn't it?
I did like the idea that the thing got his name because that was his military code name.
Was it? Was that what happened?
It was in the footage of, or in one of the sort of shots of the papers, it said Ben Grimm, codename the thing.
Did any of the other of them actually get referred to by their names?
No, I don't think so.
No.
It's difficult at the best of times to justify Mr. Fantastic, but especially in that film, there was no way they were going to get that code name in there.
No. But I mean, I feel like Miles Teller has the, like, what I could see thinking that scene would work with Miles Teller at the middle of it, but, like, it was the moment where the Thing was the one who said, like, oh, isn't this fantastic? And I'm like, is it? What have you enjoyed about this whole experience?
Yeah. Was it the bit where the military made you into a murderer?
Yeah, and now you're looking at a room full of computers when you are the one guy who has no interest in the science.
I thought he was just admiring the room.
And he also seemed like a character that often described things as fantastic. That seemed like really in his, you know, day-to-day vocab.
Maybe,
yeah. But like, yeah, so the moment where Johnny says that thing to Ben, I thought came off as incredibly mean. But I guess did you think at that point in that movie, with those four characters in the position they were, that there was a much better sequel to be made if they ever get around to making it?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I genuinely want to see the sequel. I mean, I'm excited to see. I'm hoping they do get to make a sequel because I would like to see it.
I mean, I kind of feel like the sequel is what I wanted the second half of the movie to be.
Yeah,
James, do you want to see the sequel?
I wish I could go back and erase my memory of having seen this one.
I do think almost by default the sequel couldn't be worse.
Genuinely optimistic for a sequel. I would like to see it.
I mean, I think I possibly would approach a sequel in the same way I'm approaching Batman vs Superman, which wasn't in love with the first one, but I guess you've got the tools in place that you could do something a lot better.
See, the last couple of minutes of Man of Steel I thought promised a better film than Man of Steel. But I didn't get that impression at all here. I just thought the last couple of minutes promised a film even cheesier than this one.
Maybe an injection of some kind of personality. In fact, I mean, that last scene actually did seem like it was like the prequel for the Tim Story films. It was the scene that set up the Tim Story movies.
That is a fair point.
Okay, and just briefly, I mean, James, you wanted to touch on the rights issues of Fantastic Four, because I think there's a lot of people out there assuming that the reviews have already kind of put the nail in the coffin for Fox and the Fantastic Four. What do you see happening from here?
I mean, I think anyone who thinks that this movie flopping, if that is indeed what happened, like, it's currently Thursday, you know, we don't know how it's going to perform. We know that it's done badly critically, but I think even if it's a financial flop, you'd have to have a very short memory to think the first thing Fox will do is go to Marvel and say, how much will you give us?
I mean, because, famously, they don't get on.
Yeah, to begin like, with, Marvel and Fox just aren't interested in cooperating for whatever reason, and that's fine.
And Fox like, can, if they want, shelve the sequel plans, put Fantastic Four on the back burner again, and revisit it in 6 or 7 years when the rights renew, when they need to make another Fantastic Four movie, or give it like, back.
The situation, at least as the public understands it, is that they have to make a Fantastic Four film every 7 years to keep the rights, and if they don't go into production by a certain date, they automatically revert. And especially while superhero movies are doing so well, I can't see Fox saying, let's cut our losses, because like people weren't saying about this film, Rise of the Silver Surfer was rubbish, I'm not going to go and see this one. And that was 7 years ago. So
yeah, and Marvel are in no rush to use any Fantastic Four characters now. I'm sure they would love to have them sat there with like the option to use them, but it would be 5 or 6 years before they have the time to do that.
Yeah,
anyway.
I have no doubt that Marvel would do great things if they had like Galactus and the Silver Surfer and Doctor Doom. But at the same time, they don't need them. They've got a huge catalogue.
Okay, well, we'll have to see what happens. Whether we do get a Fantastic Four sequel and whether we do eventually get some kind of X-Men crossover, which is certainly what was being floated as an idea in the weeks leading up to this movie's release. But for now, let's do some comic book recommendations based on Fantastic Four. And Matt, I believe you have come armed with a recommendation for me.
A recommendation of sorts, yes. It's a run of the original 1960s issues of Fantastic Four. It's basically issues 52 to 60.
Excellent.
And they're currently available in a collection called Doomsday, which is not a sort of traditionally published edition. It's basically it's in a series called Marvel Pocket Books, which are mostly dedicated to reprinting old issues, but sometimes do kind of newer things as well. You can certainly find them on Amazon, but so essentially it's a sample of kind of very early Doctor Doom stories, and just to give you an idea of what the original source material was for that character and those, you know, and the Fantastic Four's interaction with that character.
Excellent. James, what are you recommending me based on Fantastic Four?
I'm going to recommend you the first trade paperback of Jonathan Hickman's run on Fantastic Four. It's just called Fantastic Four by Jonathan Hickman. It's drawn by Dale Eaglesham and Neil Edwards. It's 6 issues, I think, 570 to 575. But it's the start of a very long run by Jonathan Hickman, which is actually culminating in Secret Wars. Just to give you an idea of how sort of long form we're talking. Like this was published maybe 5 years ago, and there's essentially been a continuous story in Jonathan Hickman's comics from now until this point.
Okay.
But yeah, Jonathan Hickman as a writer is very noted for his kind of structural detail and sort of scientific fastidiousness. It's similar to this film in that it's a very kind of science and exploration heavy take on the Fantastic Four, which is the way I think they work best, and also like the familial elements right up there as well. I'm not sure how easy it will be to pick up. I mean, it was the start of his run, and it doesn't explicitly build on anything else. The only point that I think you won't know about them is that it's got the Fantastic Four's children in, which are Franklin and Valeria.
Who we touched on a previous explained something to me.
Yeah. So it's got those characters in, but aside from that, it's pretty much the classic Fantastic Four as you know them.
I would just say that the thing I recommended has the sort of classic Jack Kirby artwork, and
excellent,
and it's worth picking up. It's worth looking at just for that.
Yeah, is it Stan Lee?
It is Stan Lee.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And it has, you know, it has all the family dynamic stuff we've been talking about, and the you know, and as I say, the sort of great artwork. And I'm fairly certain it has kind of like the sort of single panel you know, sorry, single page splashes that Kirby does.
Like Fantastic Four is, can you know, it's pretty much Lee and Kirby's definitive statement.
Yeah.
Like Lee, I think Lee and Ditko Spider-Man is probably better, but if you're talking about Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, it's, you know, Fantastic Four's got to be it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on now to our final section, which is the pitch. And this week, I want you to pitch me something that could still feasibly happen, and that is the potential X-Men Fantastic Four crossover. So I want to know, if you guys were planning an X-Men Fantastic Four crossover, how you would do it. James, I'll come to you first on this one.
We've talked about how Franklin Richards is a mutant before, yeah?
Yes.
Have we done that? Yeah. So Franklin Richards is a mutant with the ability to, like, shape reality, essentially. Like, he's super powerful. Obviously, that's where the crossover with X-Men comes. Like, he, on discovering he's a mutant, they take him to Xavier's to get sort of assessed, and the X-Men are in it. And that's pretty much my crossover.
Like, so that would require, in the Fantastic Four sequel, for Reed and Sue to waste no time getting busy.
I'd have a significant time jump.
Oh, okay.
It would say 10 years later.
That's just an excuse for them to meet, though. What happens?
No, that's it. They meet.
Well, frankly, I think mine's going to win by default then.
Well, that's some fighting talk.
To be fair, I was going to go with a more serious answer, but I just, my sensibilities don't allow me to marry those properties in any, like, there's no sane way to do it. I can't see how they're going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, comics history has not been that bothered about having the X-Men interact with the Fantastic Four in any really significant way.
I mean, you can list the times they've done it on one hand and they're all bad.
Mine is, you bring in old-school Fantastic Four villain, the Puppet Master, who has the who basically sort of makes dolls. He's a bit like a voodoo guy. He makes dolls with special mind-controlling clay or something, and then which enable him to, you know, mentally control the characters he's made the dolls of. So he's a long-standing Fantastic Four villain. He wants to destroy the Fantastic Four. So he basically, he controls whichever X-Men are contractually available and sends them all to fight Reed and Co. I think that's, you know, what more do you want?
I mean, basically, the question you have here is, would you rather see another superhero crossover where they turn up and fight, or do you want to see one where they have a nice sit down and talk about their child's educational future?
So Matt wins the pitch this week on behalf of Seb. I'm sure Seb will be absolutely thrilled with that. I say, after seeing that film, you use the negative zone, especially after how you've described it. The Fantastic Four and the X-Men, probably, I think it's been confirmed that they don't exist in the same universe right now on the screen. I mean, certainly, I don't know if you guys watching the Fantastic Four felt in any way that they were, that was a world that mutants existed in as well?
No.
I mean, there was no hint of it, was there?
No. So I'm presuming that they're in a different universe, and X-Men has already established that idea anyway.
Beyond their total lack of surprise at getting superpowers in the first place.
Yeah, that is true. But yeah, so maybe they use the negative zone as a way to meet, and then one of them goes over to the other universe, and then you don't have to keep them in the same universe at the end. They go back to their respective universes once.
That's just my idea, except in mine they drive to Xavier's.
Okay, well, that is it for this week. Matt, thanks a lot for stepping in for Seb and joining us. Is there anything you want to plug before you head off? Your Twitter or any writing or anything?
Actually, yes, there is. Relevant to this, my Twitter is @filmfan1971. And I've written a series of comics to screen pieces for a blog called Mostly Film. So if you just Google Mostly Film comics to screen, they'll all come up.
Which comics have you written about so far?
I've covered Ant-Man, Thor, Captain America, The First Avenger, the Avengers movie, and a couple of others as well. I think I've done both X-Men movies as well.
Excellent. Okay, so yeah, listeners, check those out. But yeah, that is probably it for this week. If you are enjoying the show, then please do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast of choice. And if you've already subscribed, then please leave us a rating or review. That is something that in the past month, John A1979 has done on iTunes. Now, he did only give us 3 stars, so there's room for improvement, obviously. But actually, he did say a lot of kind things in that 3-star review. He just doesn't like that Seb and James constantly slag off DC. Is that fair? Is that fair, James?
It's fair to me. It's not fair on Seb. He loves that rubbish.
He just doesn't like Man of Steel. It's all Man of Steel's fault. Honestly, listen further, you'll find...
Yeah, it's Zack Snyder we don't like, not DC. Like, I'm a big fan of many DC comics.
Yeah, in fact, I would say as much as come back on our next episode and you might hear a lot of positive things about DC. And if you want to find out what film that is, you'll have to wait till the end of the podcast. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter at @CU_podcast, or send us an email to cinematicuniversepod@gmail.com. You can find previous episodes of the podcast at cinematicuniverse.libsyn.com, and because this is a Film Divider podcast, on filmdivider.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
A vigilante is just a man lost in the scramble for his own gratification. He can be destroyed or locked up. But if you make yourself more than just a man, if you devote yourself to an ideal, and if they can't stop you, then you can become something else entirely. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with Batman Begins.